Welcome to the Artist Mother Podcast, featuring interviews with incredible working artists who are also mothers and compelling conversations regarding parenting and the art world. These conversations create a space for inclusivity and support for artist mothers worldwide. I'm Kaylin Butine, painter, mom of three, and podcast host. I'm so grateful you are tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode.
Supporting myself and being the person to support a child has been like a huge, huge responsibility. And then also being able to make my work and find time and be pulled in all these different directions and feeling like you're not 100% and like it feels like nobody gets 100% of me. And that has been the most excruciating part of being a single parent, I think. But it's also just taught me like you can literally do anything.
Hello, friends. I am so excited to welcome you to the Artist Mother Podcast. We have a great interview coming up with two amazing artists and mamas. Isadora Stowe is a multimedia artist based in the high desert of Las Cruces, New Mexico, with her favorite work of art, her 16-year-old, Lucia Stowe. Her artwork focuses on the narrative of environment translated and coded into complex, interdependent psychological landscapes. She exhibits her work widely and is represented in many collections across the country and in Mexico. She has been the recipient of several grants, scholarships, and awards for her work, including an award for excellence from the New Mexico Committee of the National Museum of Women in the Arts. She currently teaches art as an assistant professor in El Paso, Texas, and recently published her first coloring book, Periphery Series. And she's also one of the featured artist mothers in the book, The Motherhood of Art, which was published in April 2020. And the delightful Sarah Sudhoff is a visual artist, educator, and former photo editor for Texas Monthly and Time magazines. Her work interweaves themes of gender, science, and personal experience through photographs, which are staged and found, as well as through performance, installation, and sculpture. Her artwork has been included in exhibitions throughout the U.S. and abroad, including an upcoming exhibition at the Duseum in San Antonio, where she is their artist in residence, and she lives in Houston, Texas, with her two kids. Both Sarah and Isadora are mentors for our Fall 2020 Crit Group program, and these women are just amazing artists, and I'm delighted to share in conversation with them today. Isadora and Sarah, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you.
I see one already.
Yes. Okay, so starting with Sarah, I want you to just give us a little bit of background information. Maybe point us back to something in your childhood that got you interested in art and just a few high points along your journey that brings you to today.
For better or worse, I don't have a memory of art as a child. I can
like
remember
making art or viewing it or anything.
Yeah. I mean, I can remember making a drawing maybe in sixth grade. I don't remember going to art museums or galleries growing up. I do recall in high school, I became interested in photography. Although we didn't have a dark room or a newspaper, we had a yearbook and I wasn't interested in that. But when I got to college, I actually went to the University of Texas in Austin to become an astronomer. I grew up near, Cape Canaveral and NASA. My grandfather and father were both, Navy pilots. I thought I might also join the military and, or work for NASA in some capacity. But then in college switched to, photography. I think my only sort of, and I do consider photography art, but that was my only sort of introduction to the art world, was growing up with my father's and my grandfather's photographic slides, from their travels during war, their travels abroad, there's this washstand in our house, and in the bottom of it, it always had boxes and boxes of slides, and we would set up a slide projector. And so I think maybe those were those early influences in this interest in photography. And when I switched majors from astronomy to photography, I didn't even consider photography and the art department. It was sort of intuitive to go into the communications department. Hmm. And I worked for newspapers and magazines and fell in love with journalism. And I still love that process, that medium. I worked for two really great news magazines in my career, as well as a few others. But I think rather than, you know, finding art or coming to art through the museum, I think I came to it through the images that I was exposed to at home. Mm-hmm. And those were my grandfather and my father's military travels. And we always had National Geographic lying around. And mm-hmm. so I was obsessed with National Geographic. And I still am. And I was recently on vacation with my kids, and I always like look for the National Geographic.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, that was my first introduction to art. It wasn't until I lived in New York in 2000, when I moved there after undergraduate school to work, that I really had that first exposure to the Guggenheim and the Whitney and all the galleries. And it absolutely blew my mind. Mm. And I was living and doing this journalistic work and working for Time, and was like, oh, photography can also be this other thing. Mm-hmm. It can have this other space, or it can have this other more in-depth conversation. Yes, it can still be based in research and reality, but I can recontextualize it. I can take it out of its framework. I can still follow some of the guidelines, but I can also, create my own narrative or an extended narrative. And I ended up going to graduate school in New York and not doing photojournalism, but doing fine art in photography. Mm.
That, I think your story is really accessible, because I think there's so many artists that like wished they had that childhood. Like, I have artists, and we go to artist parents, and we go to art museums, and I'm exposed to it my whole life. And I mean, I know I'm jealous of those stories. And then, you know, I'm like, my National Geographic was like something that I always loved to read, and it was very inspiring. And maybe it was one of the most artful things in my home, you know, where like gorgeous magazines, or, you know, I contribute like my time spent outside. Like, I was, I grew up on 80 acres, and I never really thought of that as something that maybe contributed to my identity now as an artist. But I'm like, every little part, every way that you spend your childhood, whether you're, you know, an art kid or not, I think is really beautiful and inspiring. So I loved hearing that story. What about you, Isadora? Can you share a little bit about your childhood and maybe like, you know, something that you feel like put you on your path today towards being an artist?
Yeah, for sure. I think I am that art kid for sure. My dad is a printmaking professor, or he was, he's retired. But so I really grew up, I remember constantly making work. I remember being in his studio all the time. Our family vacations would be going to art museums. Like, we would go to cities just for art exhibitions. And I thought that was totally normal until my friends would say they got to go to like Knott's Berry Farm and stuff like that. I was like, oh, you get to do that? You don't get lectured in art history. You go on vacation?
You go to the water park? What?
I know. That's so, I, you know, you just think what's normal, it's normal, you know?
Yeah.
And we always had artists in our home, and my parents had met actually in the Peace Corps in Africa. So we always had, they were always sponsoring people from other countries. And we were always, we kind of had this really diverse kind of upbringing, but it was always centered about around the arts. I have two brothers and a sister, and my sister and my brother both became doctors, and my other brother owns a finance company. But I just stuck with art. It felt like totally home to me. Like, that was my language, and that's how I could communicate. And I was a little shy, and I really took to heart those lectures in front of Degas or whoever it was. And I would put the museum posters in my room and stare at them and read all my dad's books and everything on the bookshelf. So I was just constantly immersing myself in art history and making work. And, but it's funny because my family didn't encourage that. They were kind of like, hence the doctors and the finance person. But It just always felt like my own visual language. And I just thought it was endless. And I made all my own clothes in high school, and I would, you know, make my own jewelry. And I was just constantly into making and building things. And I thought I wanted to become a fashion designer for a long time too. But it just never left me, and I kept trying to leave it. So my bachelor's, it was double major in, cultural anthropology, and, a minor, and I had all these crazy minors, Native American studies and women's, I can't remember what it was, but women's studies. And, I just kept going back to the art, and it would just overtake all my time. I'd be in the studio all night. And then after I got my bachelor's, I did a lot of nonprofit work. I worked a lot with violence prevention and arts, and, I worked a lot with, at the time we used to call it at-risk youth. And it was basically, youth who were just really marginalized and were in, pretty terrible situations, and trying to help them through arts, before they went into our juvenile system. And then I worked in the juvenile system. And then I worked in, for grants for violence prevention and arts curriculum. And then, so I thought, I'll go and get my master's in public administration. So I've been working for the state for a while, and then these other grants. And I took one class, and I was like, yeah, I don't like statistics. I can't do this. And I'm working so hard, and this is like not in my nature. I'm just going against every part of who I am. And so I went back to grad school, and I had a small child at the time, my only child. She was 2. And I went back to school, and then I taught. It was a teaching program, so I was able to teach when I was in the program. It was like a 4-year program. And I just loved it. I loved teaching. That it helped me, because I had never articulated all these things, because it was always something that I was doing all the time, but I didn't have to ever explain it to anybody. So it was almost like it was a form of magic, or this kind of thing I had. I don't know how to explain it, but teaching really felt like, oh, you can help somebody else get to that place too, by really like breaking it down in the most simplest forms. And then that became like endlessly fascinating. So I'm like, oh, how can I, and then it would help me like recontextualize what I was doing and understanding. Mm-hmm. So teaching became this like beautiful thing for me. And then I get really excited when people like art, or they find themselves in art, or they feel empowered by it. Cause you know, it's just a skill. It's not a talent. It's not something you're born with. It's something that's developed. And, so I found that teaching and making art were like the things that I couldn't ever escape, and just were always there. I had a studio practice constantly, even when I had other jobs. I was just making work all the time. So yeah,
Is your master's? Do you have an MFA, or do you have art ed? Okay, yeah. So it was a 4-year MFA program.
Yeah, and for us we were supposed to be TAs, but we actually had the whole class. We taught the classes. We were instructor of record. So we were teaching, they were like giving us the curriculum, but they were like, go do it. Mm-hmm. So we were teaching all these classes on our own, and we were being paid half of what anybody else at the university was being paid, just FYI. Being TAs helping and a professor, and we were doing the entire class and being paid half. But as is on most university campuses. But yeah, that was really how I did it. And how I just kept coming back to it. I just find it really funny that I kept trying to lose it at every turn, and it just couldn't shake it.
Isadora, could you talk a little bit about what your work looks like, and maybe some of the materials and things that you use, in case anybody hasn't seen it? I know most people in our community would have seen both of your work, because I've shared it as Crit Group mentors and you know, through other outlets, but would love for you to just talk a little bit about what it looks like and your process.
Yeah, I'd love to. So I work a lot in multimedia, and I'm really interested in installations. So I'm trained in painting and drawing and printmaking, but I'm really into video. And right now, in the past couple of years, projection mapping. And I started working with the electromagnetic lab at UTEP to develop this software where it's my videos that are projected onto specific shapes of mine. And so the video moves inside of the shape. And then I add different layers of colored light, so that when you walk into these installations, you're kind of immersed in the light. And then my work, the physical work that's not video or not the Mylar shapes, is a circular virtuous. Circles, hexagons, triangles, ovals, and they're layered with paint and with screen prints, and they're light sensitive, and then a lot of it is glow-in-the-dark art, glow-in-the-dark ink, so that when you walk in, you can use these different flashlights and different parts of it appear to you, or as the light changes in the room, different aspects of the work starts to appear to you. Mm. So, but then on their own, they also look very different. So out in the light, these pieces also have a different life.
And so you use very specific imagery.
Yes. I use this 150 character and growing imagery that I repeat over and over again through screen prints and in different scale, sizes, color, yeah, so it's this repeated language that's moved around in different kinds of ways.
Sarah, could you talk a little bit about your work and what it looks like for anybody who hasn't had the pleasure of viewing it?
I would say most of my career, I've been a photographer. So most people know me as a two-dimensional artist. I started off doing photojournalism, and then in about the 2004 to 2006, when I was in graduate school, I merged into fine art photography. And during my graduate work, that photography incorporated self-portraiture and performance, as well as video. And I did that, explored that for a long time. And then in 2012, when I had an artist residency at ArtPace in San Antonio, I wanted to explore something more installation or sculptural. And I made a bench that incorporated the items that were in the photographs, which was autoclaved medical waste, which I then shredded and burned and then or incinerated and actually added to cement that was used in a bench. And that was my first sculptural piece. And then the next exhibition I had photographs, live performance, printmaking, and sculpture, and the live performance. But along the way, I've been interested in kind of coming off the wall. Since I've been a photographer and working in photography for so long, which is crazy to say now, how long I've been doing it, I really became interested in engaging more within the space. And so could I do that through photography? Could I do that through video? Did it need to be sculpture? Did it need to be an installation? Is it sound? So right now I would say I work in probably several mediums, not painting. That's not in my wheelhouse. And actually most of the things I do now are not even in my wheelhouse. And so I have to, but I'm interested. Yeah. It's like I went to school for the wrong thing, or maybe I went to school for the right thing. And now I just need more training, but I'm in my 40s with two kids and a single parent who has time or money or anything.
That's right.
So it's like, if someone asked me, I did this interview recently and they're like, how did technology all of a sudden become such a big part of your work? And I'm like, I have no idea. Maybe it was always there and I just never knew. And because I've been recently making kinetic sculptures, and this artist in residency exhibition that's about to open in October is this very large installation orbs that are like flickering with data from children reading an MRI scan done at Georgetown University. Can I program this? No, I cannot. I dreamt this thing, I pitched it, I got it, and then I had to find the team to help me. And so I work in a lot of mediums, but it's partly my hand and partly somebody else's hand. And that's been a really interesting process and journey for me. And it's also been quite a struggle for me to work in this way. I still work in photography and performance. I did a couple self-portrait pieces and performances during quarantine, although we're still in quarantine, sort of. And those are those seem so, I don't even have to think about them. They just literally flow out of me and I can't get them out fast enough. And I'd be making other photographic and performance work right now if I weren't doing this museum piece. And so there's, I have a lot of struggle, internal struggle with, am I only a photographer and performance artist because that's what I'm trained in? Or is it okay that I work in these other mediums, but I have to get fabricators to help me? And so, you know, everyone's like, oh my gosh, I didn't know you could do X, Y, and Z. And it's like, well, I can't actually do
but you can because you're an artist and you can.
Right. Right. So I hire people and lately I've been hiring programmers and it's like, I want to take this data and I want to do this with this data. Can you please help me? This is the idea. This is what it looks like. This is why it's important. This is the overall feel, look and feel of it. I just, you know, I don't have the technology, you know, these people that are doing this programming for me, they have these amazing setups. And it's not to say that I couldn't learn it, but the learning curve, I would never get to do the project. Mm-hmm. the timeline and the deadline are faster than I have time to learn.
Yeah.
And so I'm in this weird, like, paradox of like, I want to do this project. I can't physically do the project because I don't have the instruction to do it. I could learn it, but I missed the deadline.
Sarah, I want you to tell us, like, give us an example of something concrete that, like, you were like, I have no idea how to do this, but I care more about the idea and I'm committed to the idea and I'm just going to figure out how to make it happen. Like, how did you actually figure out how to make it happen? What steps did you take? Because I would just imagine being like, nope, I can't do that. Like, that's just not something I can do. So I'll just try to put that thing into a painting somehow, or, you know, like how we try to contort ideas into something mm-hmm. that we do know how to do. And then maybe the end result isn't as effective or stimulating. So like, just for people listening who maybe are stuck in that, this is not in my wheelhouse, I have no idea how to make this project happen, what are some of the tangible ways that you did make a project happen? Like,
so the best example is my Point of Origin exhibition, which first launched in January of 2019, and then a second iteration, a more expanded version, opened in March of 2020, right before, literally the week before the world shut down. And I was using data from Memorial Hermann, which is a huge hospital here in Houston, and created the first air ambulance system in Texas. And it happens to be the busiest helipad in the country. And I went to them looking for data on patient vitals on board and their flight paths. So kind of bringing in some of my military upbringing, my dad would always have these flight logs. So I was very interested in the flight logs of where the helicopters were taking off, picking up and dropping off patients, and then also the patient vitals. And so I knew I wanted to make something that honored these missions and these life-saving life-saving acts mm-hmm. that were going on board. And I couldn't see it as a photograph. Because I didn't want to make it documentary. I was like, that's going to be too abrasive. Mm-hmm. And a lot of my earlier work was very abrasive and very shocking. And I think it fit the project. Mm-hmm. But here was a project that I wanted to talk about and more in a poetic way, talk about what was happening. Because what was happening was so life-altering and stressful and crazy and just so packed with emotion, I didn't want to photograph the red helicopter. Mm-hmm. I mean, a red helicopter, red in general,
right?
Which a lot of my prior work was red mm-hmm. Because it was shot in hospitals and things like that. I was like, okay, I can't photograph it. What does it look like? How can I interpret this data in a photograph? I can't. Mm. I mean, I did eventually, but you know, I'll get to that in a second. But so I thought about what I wanted to do. I had someone help me just take the numbers and make a pattern from the numbers, like literally a map, like cartography.
Right.
When I saw those patterns, I was like, huh, that looks like a sculpture. That looks like this. And so it was like just taking that data and trying to make something that made sense from the numbers. And,
are those the sculptures that are hanging from the ceiling? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep. That's exactly.
So you can kind of see like,
yep.
You know, so what is that material and how did you then turn that into Like, you didn't produce that sculpture yourself. You had somebody else.
Well, part of it I produced. So when I got those patterns and I started flicking through the PDF or flipping through the PDF and they started to move like on my screen. I mean, not literally, but, you know, I started to see the movement. I was like, oh, that's a sculpture. Mm-hmm. Had I ever really made a sculpture besides a bench and some other small piece? No, I had never. And I was like, it's something suspended. And I said, oh, I want to make it look like a helicopter, kind of. I want it to be lightweight. I want it to oscillate and spin. These are all things that I knew. And then I reached out to an artist in San Antonio. I'm in Houston now, but I'd lived in San Antonio for 7 years and reached out to an artist who worked a lot with sailcloth because I knew sailcloth was both translucent and lightweight. And he did a lot of stuff with pine. And so I said, this is what I want to do. This is what I'm thinking about.
Did you know this artist at all?
Yeah. No, he was in my neighborhood. We used to have these potlucks. The whole neighborhood had potlucks. His wife was a teacher and he was an artist and he had two kids and I had two kids. And anyway, so, we had a friendship and I was a great admirer of his work. And so when I reached out to him, and he does do fabrications for other artists, I mean, he works for himself. He does websites for artists and then he also does fabrications for artists. And so I knew this was something that he did. It wasn't, you know, out of left field for me to approach him to say, hey, this is the idea, this is the data, this is what it looks like. And so he helped me come up with the structure of what the kite it would look like. And then I projected the patterns onto a large piece of paper, put those patterns underneath the sailcloth and stitched the pattern.
Okay.
So stitching, I'm not, you know, I didn't, I'm not a fiber artist at all. So when I say stitching, I mean taking the needle, you know, through the sailcloth, tying one knot, measuring out the length of the flight.
That's my like kind of stitching.
Making another knot, right? That's my extent of stitching, right? I would like to know more. I have started, you know, watching some videos, but you know, that was a situation where it's like I had the idea, I had someone help me convert the data into a pattern based on the data. And then I literally saw a sculpture and then found someone who I knew could help me based on their material that they were used to using and that I'd seen their work. And then I was able to come in with my own hand and at least stitch the patterns, you know, stitch is a strong word, quotes around it. You know, but it took, you know,
I was going to say, what's the timeline for this project? Cause it sounds
lengthy. Okay. So in my world,
like how long was this, a year long project?
Okay. So you're going to laugh. Okay. So in my world, research takes at least a year. In what I mean by research is usually access. Mm-hmm. So I came up with the idea. I wrote a grant. I got the money. I pitched a project to Memorial Hermann. It took me, I would say 6 to 7 months just to get to the VP of LifeLight. And then they told me I had to go back to the drawing board with my project. Then I had to ask for extensions from the Houston Arts Alliance who had funded the project. The entire timeframe from conception, from the moment I got data to the moment.
Which it doesn't even include conception, really.
Right. Yeah. From the moment like I got data to the moment it was installed was 6 months.
Okay.
But it was a year, almost a year before that, just trying to get in, trying to get the data, revising the project. And then once I got the green light, it was like, okay, what can I do with this data that fits within HIPAA laws?
Yeah.
So not sharing patient information, you know, not getting anyone in trouble, no lawsuits, anything like that. And I couldn't use numbers. Like, I mean, there's so many things I had to strip out of the data to make it work.
Yeah.
And so it became this extremely minimal show, but it was a very, very quick turnaround. And the show that opened in March of this year, I got the data, the patient vitals, December 23rd, the show opened March 6th.
Wow.
And I made 11 pieces.
Wow. So you were busy.
And I had a team of people helping me.
Wow. That's amazing. I just think it's, you know, helpful to hear your perspective of like this is not in my wheelhouse, but the idea is important enough to me, so I'm going to stick with it and make it happen. Like, I hope that's inspiring for people to hear. Isadora, do you have anything to add? Do you work that way, or are you kind of like, I do what I know I have the skills to do, and this is what I make? Like, what's your, you know, take on that?
I do a little bit of both. I do what I want to do, and then how can I do it, and who can I get to help me, and how will it work out? Like, I had no idea how to do the projection mapping. I've been wanting to do it for a long time. Also laser cutting. I was just at an artist residency and I was touring their department. I'd always wanted to use it in my work, and I ended up having access to it. So I taught myself how to learn how to use all these different programs. And I think it's a little bit of both. I rely on a sculptor to make a lot of the panels that I use, actually all the panels I use. A sculptor helps me, and I've had assistants in the past who have helped me with a lot of my work, but yeah, it's a little bit of both. I really like to have my hand in the work, and I think that I'm a little old school on that, because there's some things that I allow to be kind of outsourced, but then there's some things that to me are so sacred that like I can't. But I totally understand how other people work, and I love it. And it's inspiring to me to hear that, because I'm really interested in a lot of different things, and how to articulate those in different forms that I'm not used to is something that I'm really excited to constantly explore. Like, this show that was coming up that has been postponed in Chile, I'm going to use cast glass to create these different forms. And I've never worked with cast glass. And I like doing that with all my work, kind of pushing it, seeing how light will work, how these things that I haven't been trained in, but with a little bit of help and a little bit of just perseverance, you can make it kind of reflect that idea that you have. So yeah, I just love that, figuring out like, this is what I want to do, and how can I conjure that back up into the world, even though I don't have all the skills, I don't have all the money, I don't have all the stuff. Mm. Like, that's the practice of being an artist, which to me is like, that's just the quintessential like heart of an artist, of just believing in all these things that you have to manifest yourself. And yeah, so I love that part of that process.
Mm. I hear a lot of like resilience and just bravery in, you know, the way you guys work. It's really inspiring. All right, so let's get down to the nitty gritty. You ready? Okay, so you're both single parents, and you, both of you have had conversations with me off interview just about being a single artist mom and how difficult it is. I know so many people I talk to and interview have spouses, and they just talk up and down about how their spouse is so supportive and they couldn't do it without their spouse. And every time somebody says that, I'm just like, not everybody, you know, like, not that those comments are meant to make people feel bad, but I just have this little prick where I'm like, you know, like, not everybody has that, you know? And I just, you know, think of all the single artist moms that I know who it's just, well, I can just stop talking and let you guys talk, but I'm not going to share because that's not me. But the platform is yours to share what you want to share about your experience as a single artist. Like, I think it's just such a unique perspective to, you know, to be supporting yourself and, you know, to have this huge identity as an artist while you also have kids and you're taking on the brunt of the caregiving by yourself. I don't know if that's your situation, Sarah. I know that's Isadora, that's been your situation, but anyway, would love to hear, you know, just you guys share about that journey. Whoever wants to start.
Yeah, I can start. What I really love about your interviews is you kind of always hold everybody to that. I love how you always ask, well, how did you, you know, you ask about the support and you ask about like the money situation. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's so important, because so many times, you know, I hear people talk about these things and I'm like, how are they doing it? How are they being a full-time artist and like doing, like, what am I doing wrong? Like, why am I not like hustling enough? And oh, they have a spouse who's supporting them. And
right. They're not the breadwinner.
And has built them, you know, this place or whatever it is. And I think that sometimes it's really easy for me to be like, oh, poor me. Like if I had that, what I would do with that. And, mm-hmm. I think that a lot of being a single parent is mental health too. Mm-hmm. It's, like single parents are like, have like double the chance of being depressed as two parent households. And we have a lot of like statistical, issues and, you know, women make less than men to the dollar. And so, just supporting myself and being the person to support a child has been like a huge, huge responsibility. And then also being able to make my work mm-hmm. and find time and be pulled in all these different directions and feeling like you're not 100% and like, it feels like nobody gets 100% of me. Mm-hmm. And that has been the most excruciating part of being a single parent, I think. But it's also just taught me like you can literally do anything, really. I mean, you just have so much going against you in so many different kinds of ways, I think, that are kind of unseen. Like mm-hmm. what the weight that women carry just in general, like mm-hmm. the amount of unseen labor and the stuff that we do. And then professionally, and then, you know, in the workforce. And I just think that these things are very heavy. And I couldn't do any of this stuff without the acknowledgement of my support systems, like getting it and being like, oh, I see you haven't slept for like a day. You really need a break. Like, let me help you out. Or, you know, different kinds of things, people kind of swooping in. But I just have to rely on people in a way that I'm not necessarily comfortable with in a lot of ways. But my emotional life depends on it. Cause I just, sometimes you just need somebody, a backboard, somebody to kind of say, yeah, you know, that decision you made about your child, that's okay. That's normal. That's appropriate. That's age appropriate, you know, just to hear somebody else kind of help you out with the things that you're negotiating, struggling with all the time is incredibly important when you're doing it by yourself. It's still incredibly important when you have a partner. But for me, the weight of that support system is just kind of crucial mm-hmm. for my success in just every single area that I have.
Mm. Thank you.
I've been single. Let's see. I think I got divorced a little over 3 years ago.
Okay.
And my ex-husband lives here in Houston. I am fortunate enough that my mother also lives here in Houston. And, when I was living in San Antonio, I didn't get to see her, and I did have friends and some support system there. And then when I moved to Houston shortly thereafter, I was divorced. And so I think I've had to, you know, rely on a support network. Mine includes friends, a couple of single friends, but mainly couples, and heavily on my mom, and which doesn't always make me feel all that comfortable or mature or, mm-hmm. you know, accomplished or successful. But that's, you know, that's my situation. And I'm fortunate enough that I do have family in town. And my dad is 3 hours away. He's not that far. And I have another brother that's 3 hours away. And so they all lend support in the ways that they can. And some of it's helping take care of the kids, doing laundry. Some of it's financial, you know, because it is a real struggle to support two kids on your own without being an artist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You add being an artist on top of it. Good luck.
Yeah.
You will take money wherever it comes from.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I'm in a very precarious situation that I was working for a nonprofit from home up until January. I resigned in January because I had all this freelance photography work coming in. I was about to launch a birth photography business because that was something I'd always wanted to do. My kids were old enough now that I could leave them with my mother in the middle of the night. And all these things were sort of starting to fall into place, both as an art career, as a freelance photography career. So I left the nonprofit, had this huge show opening in Austin, and then the pandemic. Mm. So I'm on unemployment.
Mm.
And, so it's, you know, is it where I want to be? No. And it's not the first time I've been on unemployment. And luckily, and I'm on also on Medicaid. So, you know, I'm glad that these services exist, but I wish that I didn't have to use them. Mm-hmm. But I don't really have enough. I don't have any choices right now. Mm-hmm. My kids are 6 and 8. School starts next week. I homeschool them. Like most parents, mm-hmm. I don't have the ability to work. Mm-hmm. When am I supposed to work? At mm-hmm. night when I'm doing laundry or taking that 30 minutes to an hour for myself? Mm-hmm. And so it's a real balancing act, and I am not successful most days. Mm-hmm. I try very hard.
It's hard.
It's hard.
I had a bad day today, so I'm feeling yeah. the love on that. It's hard.
Isadora said something about, you know, that not everyone gets 100% of her. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I've got 2 kids and I don't get 100% of me. Mm-hmm. Neither do my kids. Neither do my friends. Neither does my family. I'm always running on fumes. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there's a better model to follow, but I haven't found it.
I think you guys are pretty great models. I don't know.
Isadora, you know, I keep going back to what you were saying, Isadora, about like trying to leave art. Am I supposed to be doing something else? Mm. I don't think so. Do I feel in some ways completely privileged to be homeschooling my children and that I can live off unemployment and make art? And I got this really great art commission and I just applied for more art commissions. And if that's my path, even though my family doesn't think it's a real job, I used to be a professor and I used to be all these things. And it's like, now am I just supposed to be an artist where I can set my own schedule and take care of my kids and work at home, and that's what's right for me, even if it means, you know, I'm hustling still. Mm. I left New York to stop hustling, and here I am still. You know, if that's my path, then that's my path, and all I can do is make the best of it. Mm. And I do feel very privileged, even though it's such a struggle and I break down most days and I snap most days and I'm not the best parent. I'm not the worst parent, but I'm not the best. I get time with my kids, mm-hmm. and they get to see me struggle and they get to see me succeed. Mm-hmm. And they can seriously tell the difference. And they know mommy's an artist and they know that art's important to me. And they also know, you know, and I'm trying to, you know, introduce them to other things that are important to me: gardening, growing our own food, traveling, being outside, mm-hmm. all these things that are passions of mine. And in addition to being an artist, and we may not have what a two-person household might have, a mm-hmm. two-family household, but I try and enrich their lives as much as possible when I can and where I can.
Mm. Thank you, Sarah. Thank you both of you for sharing that. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Artist Mother Podcast. I wanted to drop in and share a bit more about our community and the many ways you can get involved. We post daily on Instagram at Artist Mother Podcast, sharing work from artists in our community and photos from our interviewed guests, plus inspiring takeovers and lots more. Use our hashtag ArtistMotherCo so we can find your work and see this community continue to expand. We have other more tangible ways for you to connect too. Our Crit Group program offers space for you to partner with a mentor and a small group of women artists to receive feedback on your work and get lots of support. We have yearly retreats for more intentional time spent in community. Picture a long weekend away with artist mama friends, taking in scenic nature and rest, learning opportunities like workshops, and of course, lots of time to talk. We're also always scheming ways for you to share your work outside of our community, and we have put together exhibitions for you multiple times a year. We believe in your work so much, and we want you to feel as supported as possible.
Check out our offerings on our website at artistmotherpodcast.com. We even have t-shirts available in our web shop so you can represent our community. And if you appreciate what we're doing here, we would love to hear from you. iTunes reviews are greatly appreciated and help others hear about us. Thank you so much for listening, for connecting, and working together with us to create a beautiful network of artists and mothers.
All right, let's talk practically. Day to day, like, when do you make art? Because when I make art is 3 mornings a week when my spouse is watching, is responsible for my kids. Or maybe on a Saturday. So, like, just practically, are you always making art when your kids are around? Isadora, I know Lucia's 16 now, 15.
Yeah.
So you're in a little bit of a different stage, but I think it's nice to hear your experience too. You know, in contrast with Sarah's, where her kids are a little bit younger, I actually have an 8-year-old and a 4-year-old, Sarah. So our kids are more similar in age, but, well, and a 2-year-old. Can't forget him.
Or can you?
Some days I really would like to. That's horrible. Zeke, mommy loves you. No, but the two-year-old is just, it's just like, oh my gosh. Just, yeah.
It's baby number 3.
Oh, and yes, it is.
Yeah, you're just like, yeah.
Struggle.
Yeah. He's lucky. She's lucky.
Yes, it is a struggle. Anyway, I'm just wondering, like, practically, you know, you've touched on the emotional weight of it and the burden. But, like, walk me through what your day looks like or what a week looks like. How do you manage? Like, how do you make the work? How do you find time for another job on top of that, on top of caring for your kids? Are your spouses still involved? Are they, you know, like, watching the kids sometimes? You mentioned having other community members. Like, do they take your kids every Saturday? Like, just practically, how does that work?
Well, for me, as she's gotten older, like, at the beginning, my studio practice was, I used to paint really large women on, you know, huge canvases, like at 9 feet, oil painting. And when I had a baby, I was like, oh yeah, I can't do any of that anymore. And I remember being incredibly frustrated because I just kept getting interrupted, just constantly interrupted. And so I just decided I'm just going to change my entire practice because this is just insane. It's making me angry, basically. So what I did was I cut up a bunch of paintings and I cut up a bunch of drawings that were like 4x4s. And I had a toolbox with all my stuff in it. And then I just would use that as my studio. So we would, you know, she would go to sleep in her room and I'd pull it out and I'd work on a piece and I could get something done in half an hour. And then, you know, she'd be like playing on the floor and I'd work on it for half an hour. So I made it every step of the way of her growth. I've changed my practice just around her, what she needed at the time, because one, I just, like, when I go in the studio, I can be there for hours. I have to set a timer cause I just won't come back. Mm-hmm. And, that was the most frustrating part when she was growing up is, you know, you can never do that with a child. Mm-hmm. They need you all the time. So, I just decided I had to work different. I had to work faster and I had to work smaller. And then that's when I really started doing all those installations because I could do 100 pieces and put them all together in installation and feel like every day I was making a piece. Every day I was getting something done. Mm-hmm. Like, there was a real need to have a physical object made every day. That was really important when she was really young. When she got a little bit older, it was more about research and I would be happy if I got some of that done in a day. But that physical object at the beginning, and I don't know why that was so important, but that was what I needed mm-hmm. at that time. And then I just, as she got older, I would incorporate her more in my studio. So I just had a space for her. Like, I have friends who say, no, I never let my children in my studio, or that's my space. But I didn't have that option. And I felt like if I included her, cause she always wanted to do everything I was doing. So I would make like a miniature set of whatever I was doing for her. And that would buy me like 30 minutes. Then she'd go to the next station, the next day, you know? So I had this whole like situation that would buy me a couple hours. I call it stealing time. It was just, you know, she was napping, or if she happened to have a friend go over to a friend's house, you know, I was always trying to negotiate, like, can she come over for like 2 hours and I'll take the kids on this day. So I could just get some time. So as she grew, I just kind of would change my practice. And then for a couple of years, I involved her a lot in the practice. It was her drawings and my drawings together. On these maps we did a lot of, I would include her a lot of the process, and I would have music on, or we would kind of talk. It was a way that we could connect. I was trying to do kind of how I learned to connect with my dad. And then just as she's gotten older, it's been a lot easier to kind of regain more and more time in the studio. And now, like yesterday, she got her license, which is crazy. And she just left today for the first time. She went because she skateboards every day. And so she just took herself to the spot where she skateboards by herself. So, a typical day for me is, COVID time has been different than regular time. Regular time, like, just trying to find time to eat and answer phone calls was like the mission of the day. Like, how can I fit that in? But I'm going to talk about this time because I'm hoping that now is like going to be more like what's going to happen in the future. Because I used to commute 2 hours a day to work, and now I don't have that. And that's incredibly helpful for time management. And now every morning I have a standing date with one of my longtime friends, and we hike a mountain. And we do that very early in the morning. I'm not an early person, never been. But we do it, and we try to shorten our time every time. And we get to talk, and it's one of my dear friends. And it's just, it starts off the day really well. I come back home, I hit the computer, answer emails, go through. And I work, and I try to work until about 5. And then I turn off the phone. So I actually went through these questions with my child while we were waiting for the DMV. And I was like, what's my typical day look like? And I explained it to her, and she's like, that's not what your typical day looks like. Because I was like trying, she's like, you know, you go and you do this, and then you do that, and then you go back. So I go in the studio, I'll do like a layer, I'll come back and answer a phone call. Like, I'm trying to steal little time. And then what I would like to do, it doesn't happen, but I'd like to turn off my phone at like 6 and 7 and stop with the emails and just work in the studio till like 12. And then I do it again and do it again.
And you're virtually full-time professor right now.
Yeah. So it's all virtual.
Yeah. I just want to clarify that.
Yeah. And so it's a lot, like I've never been this behind in the spot in the semester. Like usually. Yeah. So, and we've been working since March. We were, we extended our spring break, but that's because we had to move everything online. So we've been working March, and we just haven't stopped. Mm. So we've just been like building curriculum, like everything that we've had to do to change everything up. Every day we've just been working on it. But I have prioritized exercise because I realize that's just like my joy. And then every day in the studio, like even if it's research or even if it's pulling off images while I'm talking to someone on a Zoom meeting and pulling images and doing research and putting it in a folder or writing notes down, I have a bunch of note cards and notes about stuff. Then I feel like it's studio time. So, and I'm realizing that the time that I thought when I was, you know, when she was younger, it just felt like it was never going to end. Like I was never going to get that time in the studio. And I just remember that so intensely. And I feel like I'm finally at that point, and it just really feels like all the cliches. I'm like, God, that just flashed by. And I'm feeling more and more like, wow, I'm really just like able to work on this stuff in ways that I haven't before. And we're going to start working on murals together, to kind of connect with her a little bit more in my studio, so that, cause I do go in there and I just don't come out for hours. And we're also going to work on skateboards together. So I started making skateboards because she's like super, you know, she's super into skating, and she had asked me to make one, and now we're going to start doing them together, designing them and making them. So I'm excited about that because she's excited about it. So cool. I'm trying to find ways to like, bring her into that space. Cause if I had it my way, I'd just go be in there all day and not talk to anybody.
And I'm assuming a home studio has always been essential for your practice. Yeah.
And she's home. I've had it in the house just because then I can go in, do a process, come back, do, you know, you can wash stuff out. And I'm real layer all my work is super layered. So I have to let stuff dry anyway. So, so it works out. But if I didn't have it in my home, I wouldn't be able to do the work that I do.
Hmm. Thanks, yeah. Isadora. Sarah, what about you? Do you remember the question?
Yeah. I would say at least currently there is no day that is ever similar, or I'm not on any type of schedule. So prior to COVID, I was working a full-time nonprofit executive director job and taking care of the kids.
Were you homeschooling at that point too?
No, not yet. So five years ago, six years ago, I became an executive director at a nonprofit in Houston. I was not making art at all. I ran my own gallery, obviously not making art at all. I was supporting other artists. Then I went to work for my brother, started making a little bit of art because that was not an art job. It was a marketing job. And so I was really missing that connection. And so when I was doing the nonprofit arts or the gallery, I was still being able to satisfy that art calling by supporting other artists and doing exhibitions and programmings. And then when I went to go work for my brother, doing marketing, although that was creative, it wasn't quite the same. And so that's when I started my Point of Origin project. And then when I went back to the nonprofit world, it was just all my creativity and everything was just feeding that and or going into that. And I didn't have any time or space or even ideas, really. The ideas started brewing and I could feel them coming, about the time that I resigned and, but I resigned in January and then COVID hit in March. So I was already working on the second, version of the Point of Origin with the patient vitals. And a lot of that labor came in January, right after I resigned, because it took so much mental capacity to run the nonprofit and do these programs and exhibitions. And I was the only staff that it had, that there just wasn't space and time for anything else or energy, really. And it's almost like as soon as I flipped off one switch, the other switch went on. And I kicked into high gear and had a, you know, like I mentioned before, I had a team of fabricators to help me pull off an exhibition in time. Recently I moved and so my life has been chaos. And, we start homeschooling next week. What I'm excited about is I have a garage and for the first time in my entire life, I will have a studio.
Yay.
Yay. 43. Yes. 2020. I will finally have a studio. It's a garage. It's not finished. It's got, some drywall. And it may not even be this year that I finish it, but it's there waiting for me when I do, find the time and the resources to, make it such. But not knowing what the future holds, not knowing if homeschooling is for the next year, for the next 2 years, whatever it is. Yeah. I don't know. I wanted a place at home.
Yeah.
And I wanted to get out of my bedroom and I wanted to get more importantly out of my head because all of my ideas are in my head. I have sketchbooks, although I can't really draw. I write down a lot of project ideas. I talk to a lot of people. I do a lot of research, but for the most part, I've just got folders and projects just all over inside my head. And so to have a little bit more space to experiment and to get them out, even if they don't go anywhere, it's just nice to have a little bit more space to do that. But overall, in terms of my process, I think about projects, get access. Sometimes access takes a year to 2 years, depending on the project. And either the project will be done, I'll have the idea and it'll be done 2 days later. Or it'll be a year in the making and then it'll be completed in a week to 2 weeks sometimes. So I work, at least if it's photography or video or performance, it's a very quick turnaround. Not a quick turnaround, but a quick, like studio practice. So like most of the time is getting their permission, lining up whatever I need to line up. Is it the space? Is it the videographer? Like for example, when I was breastfeeding my son, August, who's now 8, and I was running out of breast milk And I was really struggling with what that felt like. And I was like, how can I convey this in a photograph? I can't convey this in a photograph. So it became a performance. And then I thought about doing this live performance where I had frozen breast milk and I would cradle it, because I was thinking about the birthing classes. And we did this, we had to hold ice in our birthing class. So we would like sort of like redirect our pain. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of came into this idea of like, you know, I'm running out of breast milk. What can I do about it? Is it a photograph? I'm literally like rocking him, watching my milk dry up. And I'm like, what can I do? And then this performance came to mind. Then I was like, oh, who could I get? And then I found two videographers. Then I found this space. And a week later, I did the performance. Mm-hmm. Wow. And so that one was like super short. And then during COVID, I'm like suffocating from homeschooling and I'm completely overwhelmed. And I wanted to do this performance or a photograph with the children laying on me. And I wanted to be nude. And they were like, no, mom, we're not laying on you nude. And I was like, okay, fine.
Oh, fine. 60 pounds of pressure is a new piece?
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
That was made in April.
What? That piece is incredible. Tell us all about how you made that piece, because I just... hurt looking at
April. So like I was saying, I was just completely overwhelmed, homeschooling the kids, realizing that this was what life looked like, what life was going to be like, trying to manage homeschooling them with one computer and trying to get any kind of work done, any kind of research.
How are all these people how do you have like four computers in your house?
Yeah, like everybody. I don't. I did have a laptop, but it was at the gallery for my show. I had a kinetic sculpture running off my laptop, so we were all utilizing one computer. And so I was rotating the kids and then checking emails either on the computer or on my phone in between. And so I was feeling a lot of pressure from that. And then I had read this story about a woman in Georgia, a nurse who was found dead at home. And her four-year-old daughter was by her side. And I just like fell apart. And I just thought about like, what if I get COVID? Mm. Who's going to find me? How long are my children going to see me like this? Mm-hmm. How long are my children going to be alone in this situation? Like, how dreadful is this? That, mm-hmm. you know, this is my reality. I'm a single parent. I could get sick. And I did get sick. I thought I had COVID. I didn't have COVID, but I was in bed for 4 days and I couldn't get out of bed and they had to sort of fend for themselves. But when I read that article, I had anxiety. My chest just tightened so much. And so I talked to the kids about this performance. I was like, how can I express what I'm feeling both personally and outwardly towards other people, especially single parents, and just, you know, people that are struggling and may or may not get sick, and how do they care for their children? And all this is like revolving in my head. And I said, can I photograph you guys on top of me? And they were like, no, no, no. And I was like, okay, let's just lay down on top of me, just lay down with our clothes on and just see if I can balance the two of you on my chest, right? Laying down. And I did balance them and they were like, no, 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 mom, we're not going to do it. We're not going to do it. And I was like, fine, ruin it for me. And they've never been really in my work. I've made work about them, but they've never been featured in my work. And I was like, what else can I use? And I had some bricks in the back. I had like I lived in a condo at the time, but I had this side yard that I'd taken up all the bricks to make a play space for them. And I was like, oh, I have those bricks. I wonder if I could use those bricks. And so I put the bricks on me. And then it happened. So we laid the bricks on me. We did photos. And I said, I want to shoot it as a video as well, as a performance. So it was always both. Like as soon as I, you know, originally I wanted the kids and I was going to breathe with the kids or do something with the kids. And then when they said no, when I thought about the bricks, I was like, oh, I saw it as a photograph and I saw it as a performance immediately. Mm. And so from the time that I heard about that story about the nurse in Georgia to the time that I completed it was probably 3 days. Mm.
And did you get injured?
Did I get injured? No. When I did it.
What does 60 pounds of bricks feel like? Because, of course, our kids are on us all the time. I don't even think, like, when you're talking about your two kids laying on you, I'm like, well, that's not a big deal. But then you just see the bricks and it's just like, oh.
Well, it's more compressed and it's more, it's a shorter space. So I didn't get hurt during that performance, but I did it for the Pandemic Archive. I'm not sure if you're familiar with them. They were started. It was it's on Instagram. It was started by MFA students at Parsons, where I went to graduate school. And so I was able to participate, and I did a live Zoom performance, which was crazy.
The same piece?
Yeah, the same piece. This was last month before. And I think I did it for 10 minutes, 20 minutes. I don't remember. And the bricks were not laid quite right on me. And so the entire time I'm trying to keep them from like falling off of me. Mm. And I didn't get hurt, but I was definitely had indentations on me and was a little bit more sore that time, I think because of the brick placement. But, you know, that was one of those instances where the idea came. And then I physically had to get it done to get it out of me.
Yeah. Oh man.
And then other times it's like an idea, and then it's a year later that I get to do the idea.
Yeah.
And then just talking about scheduling, sometimes my ex-husband will take the kids. Sometimes my mom will take the kids. Before COVID, I had every other weekend off. So I would try and make work or schedule around that schedule. Now I have the kids predominantly every day during the week, and then I have most weekends off because I have them and I'm homeschooling them. So if I can, I try and coordinate any kind of studio time, research time, project development, traveling on the weekends. But with this museum installation, I've been having to go during the week a lot to meet with them, and I'll be installing September 20th. Which is like a Sunday through part of that week. So I'll have to get both my ex-husband and my mother to watch the kids and homeschool them because I don't really have another option. Mm-hmm. And so it's a constant juggling act between who's going to care for the kids. And I have to work. It's like, in some ways I'm so disorganized, and in some ways I'm very organized, and I have to schedule things out and get everybody in the know and everybody ready to go and lined up. And so I make work, I would say normally I make work in bursts. So nothing. And then in a very intense burst. And even when I was in graduate school, a lot of my work was, I was in New York and I was shooting in Texas at hospitals. And so I would plan, talk about all these ideas at school. And then I would come to Texas, shoot for a week, film, go home, get it developed, process it all, and then show it. And I'd have, you know, I'd have like 20 roles, and I would stretch out those 20 roles for the entire semester. You know, I would shoot in this very intense burst and photograph and do everything that I could and capture everything, and then stretch it out, and then book another flight and do another stint at the hospital and do another really intense session.
I
think that's how I've mainly worked for a long time.
I love hearing both of your perspectives, because like, you know, you talking about more the creative bursts and like doing like project-based work, whereas Isadora, I loved your comment about, I just had to make something every day. You know, I just have to have a tangible thing that like I'm working on, even if it's 20 minutes or whatever. Like just, you know, I think just recognizing that A, artists work differently and there's no formula, you know, and B, like different lifestyles and different, you know, communities that support us, you know, that's just what we have to do. Like you have to fit it in however you can. Do you guys have any life hacks that you can share with some other artist moms? It doesn't have to be a single parent thing, but just what is like something practical that, you know, you feel like you have not mastered, but something that's been really helpful to you that you are grateful for? Other than community and practical, actual people supporting you?
I don't have things that are practical because I'm not really good with the practical. I always like the practical to come a little later. I try to go real far and then see how far I can get. But I think for me, like the idea that anything is possible, that really is like, it just takes time, like whatever you want to do will happen. And for me, sometimes it's been 10 years, or sometimes it's been 2 years, or sometimes it's been a week just because I asked the right way or something. But the things that I want, I think I've been able to get. But I think just I've had this on my bulletin board since I was a little kid. It was like, where there's a will, there's a way. Like mm-hmm. where you want something and you put your efforts towards it and you start walking in that intentional space towards it, you'll get it. And that's what I try to do. And then there's usually, you know, there's fallout or there's not, but, that's my life hack is okay. It didn't work out today, but tomorrow it might work out. Mm. And if not, then the next day and then, the next, you know,
yeah. just keep. I like that. Sarah, what about you?
And do you mean life hack, like something that helps you manage, get through?
Anything. Your definition of like life hack.
Well, prior to COVID would have been yoga.
Mm.
That was like my community, my family, my release, my competitive side. It all got to come out in that space. And I would always do hot yoga and I love to sweat. Mm. And I know I live in Houston. It's kind of ironic. Anyway, you think I'd get enough sweat, but no. Yes, I go to hot yoga in Houston.
Ugh.
And I miss it so much. Mm. Doing yoga at home by myself is not enjoyable.
You're like, okay, kids, we're cranking up the living room.
I struggle through it. And it's actually, I would say almost painful to do. Yeah. Now it's like, I would almost rather do anything than do yoga at home without my community.
Yeah.
Even though it's an online community now, it's nothing. To me, not that it's not nothing, but it's not as fulfilling as it was before. And I didn't realize how much I was getting from it. I knew I was getting a lot from it because I was happy and I was less stressed and I was physically fit and I was eating better and all these things and had more energy and was just like more optimistic.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't realize how much it was serving me and how much I'm missing it. So what I am able to do right now, which I've always enjoyed, I played soccer for a long time, which I'm not doing right now since that's a contact sport. but sadly, although I see my teammates out there, but I'm not playing with them.
No.
I'm running. So I've always been a runner, I'm not like a everyday runner or right. 5 mile everyday runner. I'm not like that. But, you know, I do enjoy running, and I have a hard time sitting still. So it's probably why I should meditate.
Mm-hmm.
But it's my meditation.
Mm.
So it's an opportunity for me to turn my brain off or at least put my brain in neutral. And I'm still thinking and processing, but I feel like I enter into a different headspace, which is how I felt yoga. That's what yoga did for me. I was still thinking and processing and troubleshooting, but from a different vantage point. And mm-hmm. I feel like running is able to do that for me. And I feel guilty when I try and put that first.
Mm-hmm.
But I can see the consequences if I don't do that, when mm-hmm. I don't put myself first and when I don't put prioritize exercise, it's actually very damaging to me. And also right now during COVID, I don't have work really. Mm-hmm. And so I see my kids. And so the only opportunity for me to be around other people, even from a distance, is if I'm out running.
Mm.
You know, I wouldn't count the grocery store.
No.
Like I'm trying to speed through and get away from people. But, you know, when I'm out running, it's like, oh, hey, oh, you know, like, you know, there's some kind of community, there's some kind of conversation, even yeah. if it's just a quick hello. And that's so needed, I think, for everybody right now. And especially me, that like, I realize, you know, how much I need it, how much it's essential for me, and how much that if I'm not getting it, that I'm doing a disservice to myself and my kids.
Hmm. Okay, just two more questions for you guys, and then we'll wrap up with our final five. Interested to hear, and, you know, it's COVID, so everything is up in the air, but what are some goals that you have for your art career in the next 6 months?
I have a lot. I wrote them down.
I feel you about like goal setting.
If there's a will, there's a way.
I won't take too long. Well, there was that show, you know, I was working with these women, these amazing women in Chile, and we were going to do this show. It's called Leaking Women, women holding up the ceiling. And I'm hoping that somehow in the next 6 months, we'll be able to kind of put that together. I have another solo show coming up. It got pushed. I don't know when it will happen. It keeps getting moved and bumped, and a lecture series. So I'm really excited about those because I'm going to push my work a little bit more in this exhibition. It's at Western New Mexico University. Mm-hmm. And then I've been working on these YouTube videos for art appreciation and like just basics for art for my students. And I want to convert them and make them public. So they have all these different resources to look at. And I've been working on an artist professional practices workbook that I mm-hmm. want to make available for students, because I think there's a lot of stuff that specifically marginalized students deal with. And so I just want to, I want something that's just really, really accessible. Working with my kiddo on some more design projects and stuff like that in the studio. So just expanding my work, working on canvas for the first time in 16 years, which I'm really excited about.
Ooh, that's exciting.
Yeah, I'm interested to see. It's like, so I really stopped when she was born. And so now I kind of feel like, oh, well, maybe I can try it. So those are just like the projects in front of me. And then there's all the professional stuff with work that I have some professional goals, but those are just for my work in the next 6 months that I hope in 6 months I can say, yeah, all those things were accomplished.
Love hearing that. What about you, Sarah?
Well, I'm hoping that I successfully install my exhibition in San Antonio and that it has a great that I get good feedback from it. There's the opportunity for it to travel. Mm-hmm. It's being embedded inside another exhibition. And so I'm hoping that the curators get a really great response and that I'm possibly invited for it to travel with the exhibition. There's also been some interest from some schools here in Houston about potentially bringing it to Houston that serve students with learning disabilities, which would be really great since the project focuses on dyslexia.
Nice.
So I'm really interested to see where that project leads. And I've never made work specifically for children or about children. So I feel like it's this new avenue that's kind of opening up, and I'm interested to see where that takes me. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, if I am on this journey to be a full-time artist, however I can make it happen, I would really like to spend more time trying to get my work shown. Hmm. I used to be represented years ago, but for several years, that wasn't my focus. And now that I'm sort of returning to that space, I feel like I need to be a better advocate for myself. And I have all these amazing bodies of work that have shown maybe once or twice, and they really haven't traveled. And I realized with COVID, that's a huge hurdle to overcome, but the work is already made. It's already being stored in my house. So there's really not a big hurry, but, you know, to start working possibly in 2021, 2022 exhibitions with some of the work that's already made, I would really love to see that happen and see this work that I've been so passionate about really, really get the life that it deserves and get outside of Texas or, you know, the limited showings it's had. I recently applied for two huge public art commissions. And so the museum one is sort of this hybrid artist residency public art commission. And so these other ones are straight up public art commissions, and I've never done one of those before. And again, that's sort of a space that I'm interested in exploring. I have a really good friend here in town, and that's what she's been doing full time for several years. And I'm kind of tiptoeing into that, you know, thinking about balancing my own art practice and also these public art commissions, which is, you know, you work with committee and you work with fabricators, which I'm used to doing. And so maybe it's this really nice extension of my practice. Mm-hmm. that I want to explore. Again, a huge learning curve, and all, you know, I need to learn SketchUp so I can actually design my ideas.
Yeah.
And because I cannot draw at all. So that, you know, to learn some new software programs. And then something that happened a couple months ago that I would like to continue is to return to teaching. So I was a professor for 7 years, and then I went into arts administration and really missed teaching. I had some opportunities to curate shows and be mentors, and I'm really excited to be a mentor for you starting next week. And so looking for more mentorship, teaching, support opportunities, because I do really miss working with students, advising students. This summer, I was able to do MFA studio visits through Zoom with Parsons and then give the MFA students a lecture, present on my work. And so that was really wonderful. And I also, I think, lectured at RISD. And I'm looking for other opportunities like that, just to get in front of students, and to get myself back into that practice and connect in some way. Even if I'm not teaching, there's so many different facets that I can be connected to or be involved in that I'm, you know, very interested in pursuing that as well.
Thank you. I hope all of those things are accomplished for both of you. Big, big things. Okay. The last question I had, this just came to me just hearing you guys talk. It wasn't on our list, so I hope that's okay. But I just wanted to hear you guys share a little bit about what in your life, and this can be art, motherhood, whatever. But where do you feel like you feel the deepest joy, or what things bring you the deepest joy in your life?
For me, it's making work and seeing people kind of have an experience with it that they don't know that I'm kind of watching. Like, one of my most favorite experiences was I ended up double booking 2 solo shows at the same time because of it just randomly happened that way. So I ended up spending like my entire winter break making this body of work, and the whole time I'm beating myself up, like, why didn't I go on a vacation? Why didn't I go, you know, why didn't I do this and that? And I had to kind of work just over time to make this extra body work. So long story short, I'm at the first opening, and I got there late, of course, because that's just because it was out of town and I had to, you know, get it, you know, it's just always complicated. So I'm there and nobody knows who I am. And it was a first Friday opening, so there were hundreds of people there, and they were moving around the room and they were talking about the work, and they were like taking selfies, and they were super into it, and they were just like exclaiming about the work. And I was like, oh my God, like this and it happened to be my 40th birthday. So I was like, this is it. I've made it. This is my moment of joy. Like, and nobody has to know. Like, it was just so, it was really wonderful. And I realized, like, you know, sometimes you don't know why you're making this stuff all the time. Like, I have these constant conversations with myself. Like, what am I trying to say? What is this about? Why is this important? Like, who is this to, will people even get it? And they were getting it, and they weren't reading any of the literature, and they were just, and that was just a huge amount of joy. I do get a lot of joy out of, sharing my work with other people. But you know, it's going to sound creepy, but sometimes I get a lot of joy out of watching my child sleep. I have a series of photographs, and she was tiny, that are just like chronicling her sleeping. Because there's just like their faces change, and they're just a little different when they sleep. And I can watch her in a way that she doesn't really let me watch her when like we're together. Because they change so much, and they grow so much. And I think as a single mom, there's always that guilt, like I'm not doing enough, or I'm not spending enough time, and I'm not, and I don't think that's just for single mothers. I think that's shared, you know, across the board. But, so I have this like series of photographs of her sleeping, and, you know, sometimes I just look at them and they kind of, I don't know. It's kind of like a moment of Zen. I don't know how to explain it, but she's going to be horrified to hear about that, because that's kind of. Right. Like, oh, this man, and she's not going to listen to this. Yeah. So it's that combination of the, you know, the things that I've created, I think kind of bring me the most joy.
What about you, Sarah?
Well, obviously making art brings me a lot of joy. I think it's always been part of me, whether I knew it. And as you said, you know, like finding a way to make it happen, finding a way to manifest it physically, in a way that's accessible. And like you, Isadora, watching people's reactions or hearing people's reactions, when they don't know we're watching, is really beautiful. And I've been very proud, a couple of times where my work in someone's had a really visceral response to my work. And they've been able to explain to me what's going on with them and why they're having that reaction. And it was, I wish I was a better writer than I am, but it's like photography and art are my visual, they're my language. Mm-hmm. And I'm able to much more clearly and succinctly communicate a multitude of feelings and emotions and ideas and history in an object more than I am in a word or words. And I feel so complete, I guess, when that is translated immediately to somebody else, and being able to watch it and be part of that process and part of that response. I also love traveling with my kids. I love to hike, and I wish I was in New Mexico and had a mountain that I could go climb at my door. Oh. So Isadora, I'm coming to visit you. With my children. Just I hope so. I was in Santa Fe in October, I think, and I went hiking there, which was really wonderful. I was there for Review Santa Fe, which is a big photo conference. But that, I think, was the last time I really hiked, which is sad to say. I often go to Big Bend with my children and love hiking there. I also like going to the beach with my children. Normally, we go to Florida every summer to visit my grandparents, their great-grandparents, but we canceled this year. And just today in the car, my daughter, who's six, was saying, "Mommy, can you remind me of where my name comes from?" And she was talking about her middle name. She's named after her Cuban grandmother for her first name, Georgina. But her middle name is from the Isle of Skye in Scotland. And I told her about the first time I went to Scotland when I was 24. And then when I went back when I was 32. And that it's one of the most beautiful places I'd ever seen. And that hopefully someday I will take her and her brother to visit Scotland. Because I primarily only traveled in the United States as a child, but those are my fondest memories, is going hiking in Tennessee, going to the beach in Florida. And those are the things that I moved all the time. And so for my life, the constant was my grandparents in Tennessee and my grandparents in Florida. That was the constant in my life because I never had a constant or a state, you know, I was never in one place for very long growing up in a military family. And so I've always tried very hard to make sure to take my kids on, you know, maybe not extravagant vacations, but to go hike and to go swim and to go explore. And, you know, just a couple weeks ago, I took my kids to Wimberley, which is in the Hill Country in Texas. And both my kids can kayak by themselves.
Oh, cool.
I have these great videos and photos of my six-year-old launching her kayak and having her life vest and taking the rope off and paddling and turning around and her and her brother going up and down the Cypress Creek. I was just like, yes.
Oh, yeah. That's so awesome.
Yeah. That made me just as proud as making a piece of art, watching my kids. Yeah.
I love that. Okay. Final five questions. You guys can answer these as briefly as you want. I'll read a question and then have both of you share your answer, and then we'll move on to the next one to wrap up the interview. Okay. So, and I changed these questions from last year. So these are a new set of questions that I'm doing. So Isadora, why don't you answer first? Tell me, who is your biggest art crush?
Who isn't? I see, this is hard, but this is my favorite, because my favorite people are artists, but, I just learned about this artist, Tanya, Candiani's work, and she's a Mexican artist. And I, saw this interview at the Rubin, about her work, and her work was like, I don't know if you've ever seen an artist where you're like, oh my God, why
do I even try? Like, she's so amazing. Like, I had that experience, and I very rarely have ever had that experience. And she was one of those people. She uses sound, poetry, technology, and craft and language and her work and her installation. She got the Guggenheim, I think, in 2011. And her work, she's just spectacular. She's from Mexico, and just check out her work because she's...
Say your name again.
Tanya Candiani.
Okay. Thank you. Sarah, yeah. What about you? Biggest art crush?
Okay. It's a tie. I'm sorry. Marina Abramović.
Could definitely see her influence in your work.
For sure. And I've met her several times, and she kissed me on the cheek. And when I watched her Guggenheim performance, there was like this magnetic, like she was my grandmother. my art mom, my spirit art mom.
You got to go see The Artist Is Present in person?
I did see The Artist Is Present. I was living in Texas and flew up, but during graduate school, she did 7 days at the Guggenheim performances for like 7 hours. And I went and watched the last day of the entire performance. Wow. And at the end of the performance, I'm walking up the rotunda at the Guggenheim. So I'm eye level with her and I'm smiling at her like the last half hour. And like she finishes and she gets down and she comes up to me and gives me a kiss on the cheek and says, I could see you.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah. And then she signed my book.
And that's awesome.
She like out, you know, drew her hand and said for Sarah.
That's awesome.
And then Teresa Margolies or Margolies. I'm not sure if you're familiar with her work, but Mexican artist. Just the way that she takes such heavy, layered, intense subject matter and just the way that she installs her work, and it's just phenomenal. I hope to work like her someday.
Hmm. Okay. Sarah, why don't you start? You kind of already answered this, but maybe you have a different answer. What is your favorite place to travel or a dream trip you'd like to go on? Is it Scotland still?
Oh, well, I've never been to New Zealand. I've been to Australia many years ago, and I've never been to New Zealand. So it kind of combines my hiking need and my beach need.
Yeah, there you go.
So yeah, I'd love to go to New Zealand.
Isadora, what about you?
I think my answer would have been super different before COVID. But now
you're like, Arizona, that sounds great.
I'll go to a parking lot. And I mean, that was even my answer. Like anywhere where I could see physically, like my family and just hug them in person. Cause usually I've never gone this long without going to see them in their cities. And, so I said New York City. That's where my youngest brother is, just because I have a love for New York City, and I think I need to see it okay to also like that's also part of, but it'd be great. So yeah, it's real low bar right now.
Yeah.
I just wanna hug some people in person. That would be an ideal vacation for me right now.
New York is always a dream place to travel.
Yes. Yes. Gives so much. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. What film or book has inspired you greatly?
For me, I wrote Born a Crime by Trevor Noah. It's one of those books where it was just so moving because he's so brilliant, and the way he just addresses human nature and humor, he makes fun of like these things that are just, you know, so horrific, or he explains them in a way that's just so humanizing. And then his mother is really just like the amazing heroine of his story. And so I that book I love. But there's also this other book that kind of I mention it to every single person all the time. It's by Mark Gober, and it's called The End to Upside Down Living, and it's about consciousness. And it's about all these scientific studies about consciousness and interconnectivity. And I'm really interested in that in my work, you know, with quantum physics and all the stuff that I deal with. And so it's super up my alley, but it's really accessible. And it's a mind-changing book. It's wonderful.
Thank you.
Highly recommend it.
Sarah, what about you?
This probably, I don't know if it'll come as any surprise. If you know some of my work, I obviously have a deep love for the macabre. And for historical journalistic stories. So Devil in the White City is one of my favorite books.
Nice.
I can't say it's inspiring because I don't want to be a serial killer.
Yeah.
But I just find it very, I find books, suspenseful books that are nonfiction about our history and about the way our mind works and about how society functions, and something that's both macabre and medical and in research and the turn of the century in Chicago. And
I loved
that. Yeah, there's lots of layers in that book, and I just fell in love with it. And I've read several of Eric Larson's books. And then The Handmaid's Tale. So it is
so good.
Yeah, it I probably can't say a lot of the reasons why I like it, but both the book and the show both made me furious, made me cry, made me hopeful, made me feel empowered, and loop it back again and again and again.
In 10-minute segments.
I would feel all of those things over and over and over again. And, you know, and even today, and I mean, there's so many moments in my life and what's happening in the world and what's happening in my own family that I just, I'm like, oh yeah. It's, that I can connect to and draw from and think about and also relate and know that, okay, you know, this is what she was going through. You know, I can equally survive what I'm going through.
Yeah. It's so, 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 so good. Okay, Sarah, what's your favorite meal?
Okay, so flan, although that's not really a meal.
It can be.
I had flan last night at my mom's house. It was her birthday. I'm half Cuban, so I love flan. Anything seafood related. So I'm a huge pescatarian.
Nice.
I also like dessert.
So sugar and fish.
Isadora,
what about you?
Any salad that I did not prepare that is just like to the nines, like every single vegetable, it's vegan, it's gluten-free, and I didn't make it and it was like labored over, that would be the ultimate meal for me.
There's nothing like a well-labored salad.
Yes. Gives you everything you need. Yes.
Yeah. Okay, both of you. My last question is just, who do you want to give a shout out to, you know, somebody in the spirit of community? And everybody wants to mention a million people. It's okay if you just want to share a name or two. But just like to give you guys the space to say thank you to somebody who supported you in your work. So, Sarah, why don't you start?
I would, oh God, it's hard to pick one person. But my former professor and advisor at Parsons, Martha Burgess, who is an artist living in New York, she showed me that the direction I was going was not only accessible and appropriate, but that there was a history before me. They were ideas, and thoughts that I felt out of sorts, out of place, not like my the other students in my class. And I felt very lost. And she showed me that, that was my direction and that was my path. And that was my voice that I needed to honor.
Isadora.
I kind of wrote a paragraph, but I'm gonna try to go through it really quick. And it's just because I seriously, like, if I say one person, I cannot, you know, not mention the other person who, you know, answered the phone in the middle of the night and the other person who comes and picks me up or the other person who, you know, Sharbani Das Gupta, Devin, Soledad Pinto, Zoe Spiliotis, and then
my other single mama, she owns a tattoo business, and she just inspires me all the time because she has two children, and she's doing it all on her own, Diane Basler White. And then, of course, my family, my dad, Spencer Fiddler, my stepmom, Deborah Wrench, and my brothers, Ari and Trevor, and my sister, who's just like a super powerhouse of positivity. Like, if she's just amazing, Anna. And then I have these other friends who literally on a daily basis or on a weekly basis, they help me, and Rebecca Bergson, Pamela Bush, Evelyn, Erin Galvez, Jasmine Herrera, Ilana Lapid, Lizzie Mason, Marissa Sage, Laura Turan, Nicole Vasquez, and Leah Wilmuth. And I have to give them space because, man, I don't think I could exist as doing all the things I do without their weekly, daily help.
Thank you. Okay, last promise, final question. Where can people find you? Instagram and website. Just like to make sure we put that on here so people listening can follow you guys. Sarah?
Instagram is my name, Sarah Sudoff. Website is sarahsudoff.com.
Perfect. Isadora?
Isadorastowe.com and Instagram at Isadora Stowe, Facebook Isadora Stowe. So
great.
That's me.
Inspirational, both of you. Thank you so, so much for your generosity, for sharing. Can't wait to publish this episode. Everybody's going to love it. Thank you.
Thank you.
The Artist Mother podcast is curated and produced by Kaylin Butine. Music by Josh Middleton. Editing and mixing by John M. Butine. Please visit www.artistmotherpodcast.com for episode notes and to find out how you can further support this podcast.